Jonathan, good afternoon.
Hello there. I was I missed my name on the roll call there, and I thought, if I messed up.
You were right at the start, my friend.
Okay, there we
good
go.
To have you.
I'm actually there's going to be some noise. I'm in a taxi heading towards the Russian embassy, so you will hear some loud NAFO noise going on in the background.
Oh, that's excellent. It couldn't be better. All righty. Armadillo, you had a question.
Hey, first of all, I want to thank you guys. I tapped something on my phone. It says soundboard. I've never seen that before. I was trying to go back on mute there for a moment, but if something strange, I'm going to just set my phone down for a moment and just try to talk. Okay. So first of all, thank you. Thanks everyone for being here. Thank you, Axel, and everyone who comes on here and leads the space, and Mockers. And I know many of us Americans or Yanks aren't quite awake yet, or I would be saying thank you to a number of other people. You guys do this day in and day out. I wish I could spend more time on Ukraine. I do tune in when I can. What I want to talk about briefly is something called a petition to discharge. You guys have probably spoken about it some in the last few days. Bill Pascrell and I'm just about to post something on my timeline or share this. Axel, you may already know where I'm going with this, but I'm sure you do, in fact.
Sure, I do. But as long as we make it short and snappy, that'll be great, because we will be discussing more about that later today. But do it now, post it out so that people know and are aware, and then we'll go to Jonathan and Edward Hunter Christie. But carry on.
Okay. The petition to discharge will force the vote. If it's signed by 218 House members, it will force the vote to get the aid flowing to Ukraine. So I want to encourage everyone to do that. The other thing I want to encourage very briefly, I will touch on this as well. Super Tuesday is coming up. Many states have early voting. I am planning to go vote today. Personally, I'm going to vote for Nikki Haley. I'm going to vote Republican for Nikki Haley because I want to send a message in any way I possibly can that what Trump and the ultra MAGA are doing to hold up aid for Ukraine is unacceptable, and it's got to change. Okay, so now I've said my piece. I will attempt to get back on mute. Thank you very much, sirs.
All right, much appreciated. Very briefly, Johannes, if you have a pertinent question to the last segment, let's do this now quickly, and then we'll go to you, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a question regarding, well, your discussion on the state of Western politics, which was basically you had those incredibly depressing assessments, and at the same time, I remember a couple of days ago you talked to a Ukrainian serviceman. I don't know who he was, and where I think. You made it very clear that the West is not abandoning Ukraine. So where, can you explain to me, where do you stand on this? What is your overall assessment then?
Oh, my personal one, or Jonathan's, or Jochen's? I could hand it to both of them.
What is your personal view? I mean, we see that Germany is not doing enough. Biden is not doing enough. Meloni is not doing enough. I mean, everybody is letting Ukraine down by now. Everybody is caught up in this short-termism with the upcoming elections, also the European elections. It's probably going to get worse because we have this wave of right-wing populism, I guess, which is going to garner a lot of votes. So I just wonder if you can still give me some hope.
Let's address this. By the way, we'll do this as follows. I'll go to Jonathan, and then I'll ask also Jochen, and then we'll carry on. Jonathan, what's your view?
Well, I mean, the challenge here, of course, is the media also thinks in very short-term fashions. It also thinks in terms of narratives, and it looks at reality and then tries to fit it in a narrative. So if you had Ukraine triumphant a few months ago, they can't run with that because we've done that. You have to have something new. You have to be switching up constantly. So my concern is that the media, and the media certainly influences politics and decisions, and it does seep through to the public, even to activists. It flip-flops between extreme points of view, neither of which are really truthful. At the moment, Ukraine is under huge pressure because of the ammunition famine, but it is shooting Russian planes out of the sky, left, right, and center. You have a further AWACS, an incredibly expensive piece of kit, a very strategic piece of kit, shot out of the sky yet again yesterday. Dominance of the Black Sea Fleet, the return of Ukrainian exports to pre-war levels. It's a mixed story. And I think the media is incapable of reflecting that sort of complex, nuanced narratives, unfortunately. We shouldn't be overtly influenced by that. We should look at the complex reality. Axel, over to you.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I'm trying to get our friend Edward on this, but that seems to have worked. Excellent, wonderful. Yeah, I tend to agree that the media cycle exaggerates a bit, and the media perception exaggerates a bit as to what is happening. I tend to believe that under the radar, the preparations for the support of Ukraine have been extensive, comprehensive. The logistics do stand. Zhezhov is still there. The biggest, it is currently the second largest airbase of NATO forces and the US Air Force in Europe. I tend to believe that we still can deliver and we can still up our game. And I tend to believe that this will work out. But it's the hard slog which makes it so utterly decrepit and frustrating for people. But then again, we should not give up. We should just make sure that this hard slog does not disenchant, does not also disrespect those who are actually fighting. And by the way, let me just say hi to our other guest, Edward Hunter Christie, who has joined us just now. And I think it's a perfect timing in that regard. Edward, good afternoon. Thank you for joining. Edward, can you hear us?
He's muted.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Perfect.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay.
Loud and clear.
Super. Thanks a lot.
Right here. Well, you heard the question. Before I hand it to Jochen, who will probably give us his view, but why don't you start right with this? I mean, is this just the hard slog we have to go through because there's no alternative?
I missed the beginning of the question, the hard slog in
what sense? The question was, okay, yeah, Johannes' original question is, because we had a discussion with Ukrainian service members, a captain of the Ukrainian armed forces a few days ago, where we very much also tried to console him in one regard, that whilst there is this political conundrum in the West, that ultimately the support scheme, which is sufficient in order to keep them going, will be there. And there's a significant majority in Western societies willing to support them, albeit that this political will has not been formulated yet. So you could go through the whole motions. But it seems at the moment, that's why I said it, that there's a frustratingly difficult period during which we seemingly have to endure and fight through in order to get to the point that capabilities are built up in Western Europe. And the US releases what it has available. That was the hard slog I referenced. Do you think that is a fair description, or do you see this even more skeptically?
I'm actually in a somewhat pessimistic mood right now because of what's going on in the United States specifically. And I think that what we're in danger of encountering is a negative cascading effect or a negative domino effect whereby, of course, if the United States continues to fail to deliver and does not resume its assistance except through sales, which is another channel, then, of course, there will be a temptation for certain large Western European states to also not fully compensate. And we could have a situation where it is really only the smaller, most determined Eastern Flank and Northern Flank allies who really do absolutely whatever it takes to help, but it might not be quite enough. And then you have a looming threat or risk that at the top level in major allies, that the perception of the entire war starts to shift towards a temptation of appeasement. And that, that's really, really the danger I see now. So I think a lot hangs in the balance with the United States getting back on track. And I do frankly see a major danger right now. So sorry to be a bit more pessimistic, but I think
That's half. I don't disagree. The risk of this negative cascading effect, I think, has been is very well remarked, because this is how politics can work, and this is how politics can then filter by means of lack or good communication into the public mindset, and then it begets the solution it actually dreads originally. But if you
Axel, I can jump in with a last word on that as well.
Yes,
I think, whereas the realistic assessment may be negative, and there's an awful lot to feel negative about, the ammunition famine is deeply threatening and needs to be reversed. The other thing I'd like to remind is that politicians, unfortunately, like to align themselves with a degree of certainty. They like to align themselves with victory and success and bathe in the glory of that, even if they haven't had too much involvement there. Why did, I think, Boris really leap for Ukraine and sort of take some huge risks? Because he must have deep down thought that it would work and it would reflect well on him. Let's be cynical. You can do it for a number of moral reasons. You can also do it for self-interest reasons at the same time. The challenge here is if we propagate negative narratives, politicians will think, well, hang on a second, do I want to be associated with failure? Do I want to be associated with something that may not give me electoral advantage and may reflect badly on me? So even though I do the right thing, it goes wrong, I'm going to be blamed for it. So I think it's incredibly important to keep up positive narratives. It's incredibly important to talk about the fact that Ukraine not only can win fully, but it's practically impossible for Russia to fully take the territory of Ukraine. And the more territory they take, the more partisan activity is gonna devastate them. So there are some unrealistically negative attitudes out there. It's important to create this groundswell of idea that Ukraine not just must win, but can win, and encourage politicians to align behind something that will reflect well on them.
I think this is a very veritable point, that the battlefield is significantly harder for Russia to dominate, to the point that it could actually make the inroads it seemingly declares and highlights, both through its dissemination of information and narratives. I'm not talking about the rather often inebriated former politician, Mr. Medvedev, but then there you go. But Putin himself has stated this before many times over, what he actually intends to do, and we should take him by his word in that regard, as opposed to what Ms. Zahrenknecht says. But I would like to pass the question just briefly also to Jochen. Jochen, do you think that whilst we all are often frustrated, and I share the frustration with Edward that our politicians are not doing enough and that this can have pose a risk, but how do you see this, Jochen? Is it just the fact that we need to, say, pull ourselves up with our bootstraps, that we just simply have to act finally?
Oh, well, yes, partly certainly that. I agree with everything that's been said, especially regarding the need to counteract this negative cascading effect that is so visible in the media. And that is something that specifically we in the expert community should see as being called upon to act responsibly in this regard. There's also another issue, which is the importance of seizing Russian assets, seizing Russian central bank assets and so on, in order to make them available for Ukrainian procurement, arms and munitions procurement, most important of all, which is something that many of those Western European states that Edward just mentioned are very reluctant to do, are quite hesitant to do. And it's something that needs additional legislative work to be done. It needs juridical work to be done. So this is something that we should be emphasizing more if we should land in the unfortunate situation in which U.S. assistance would no longer be available and Ukraine would have to recur more to sales, actually. In that case, seizing the assets of Russia would become more and more important for the future of the war effort. That's something I would like to highlight in addition to what's already been said.
Now, Edward, how do we bring the message out, and how do we dissect and differentiate it? Because evidently, we discussed it very early on today with General Mick Ryan, where he led us all back to how the will in the societies and the will in the political elites needs to be there. When you say, and I share that view, that there, this will has not formed, still, that does not mean that it can't. It does not mean that if we don't, if we, as the whole community, the population, literally rise up and shout and state the noise, it makes an impact, because I think the wisdom of crowds is there. The example in Germany, that support in Germany has risen by 10% with one month, from 52 to 62. That's the middle of the roll poll. It's nothing unusual. We're waiting for the Institute of Allensbach to bring us a little bit more details. But 10% growth with 1 month to support Ukraine, that's massive.
Sure, no, absolutely. And I think we all know the trajectory. We've seen what happens. We've all been following this war and these discussions very, very closely. The German case, I think, is extremely instructive. We have seen, and we all know that this has happened, and denials, claims to the contrary by people close to Chancellor Scholz are not valid. We know that peer pressure works. We know that pressure from the public, but of course, in combination with major political figures, and you mentioned some of them earlier in your talk, whether it's Mr. Hofreiter or Kiesewetter or others, what we have in Germany is really an extremely instructive example, where you have significant parts of the political landscape, plus significant parts of the media, plus significant parts of the expert community, plus significant parts of the public, and also Germany's allies, all pushing to basically force the hand of Chancellor Scholz. And I fundamentally believe that is exactly what happened repeatedly. And most clearly at two key moments, of course, at the beginning of the war, when Germany was still refusing to give any military assistance to Ukraine. And the second very visible moment was on the decision on tanks. And now we have a third major gate, a major difficulty, which is on Taurus. But again, we see the same attempt to sort of pile on Scholz. And I think piling on Scholz is absolutely the right thing. Many of you might know the name Ulrich Speck. He's a very good German analyst. He just tweeted out today, guys, the pressure, he tweeted in German, the pressure on Scholz has to be increased or else the disaster looms. And that's absolutely right. The way this works actually is that those who do not want to help Ukraine sufficiently, if you look very carefully at how they operate, they don't come out and say openly what it is that they want to do, because they know that that would be a very, very bad sell. If you look at the US, even Trump is not saying openly the game he's playing at. But what I suspect, what we all suspect, is that he directly told Speaker Johnson, you block this thing no matter what. It's not going to happen. And when Trump is interviewed, he does his usual game of trying to change the subject and then trying to blame Europeans for not doing enough. Then he makes up numbers that are not true. He claims that we're helping less than the US. That's false, and so on. But then, of course, his supporters are none the wiser and they don't really know. So that's his game. But the fact is that he has to obfuscate, he has to lie, he has to misrepresent what it is that he's actually trying to do. And Scholz and his people, of course, they also try to be quite discreet. His key people, Plötner and Wolfgang Schmidt, they don't come out in public a lot. And they're not too explicit about what they really think, because they can't. They know they would be ripped to shreds politically if they did. And it happened. If you look at Wolfgang Schmidt, who's a minister-level top official with Scholz, I think many people remember this anecdote back about a bit more than a year ago. He gave, actually at a public event, at a serious conference, the argument that Germany shouldn't give tanks to Ukraine because it would be a propaganda victory for the Russians to have captured a tank with a German Iron Cross on it, which of course made everyone make fun of him. Have you ever heard about paint? And anyway, if you transfer equipment, well, of course, then it has the insignia of Ukraine, not the insignia of Germany, and so on. So, but I mean, that's the level. So the people who are blocking assistance, unfortunately, some of them are very powerful and they're just in the right places to have a disproportionate influence. But whenever they're actually cornered and they have to try to justify their choices, they really, really fall apart. So what we have to do is just continue everything that we've been doing to put pressure through all possible channels. But for most of us, that's only just through public expression. But we just have to carry on. And I really like what Jonathan Think was saying earlier. Yes, politicians do want to be associated with victory, not defeat. And maybe that's also something we could do towards Trump. I mean, Trump wants to abandon Ukraine. In other words, he wants to be a fucking loser. He's a loser, okay? I mean, he's obsessed with winning, 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 talking about winning, 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 and so are his supporters. But why not, and here I don't know what American colleagues think, but why not present what Trump is actually trying to do as being something that a loser does? He's not a winner, he's a loser. That could be one angle of attack. But I think fundamentally...
It's an argument Nikki Haley has been using in recent days, as you know. She highlighted what is blatantly obvious, that he has lost 2 midterms and 1 presidential election.
And he wants to lose a war. And he wants to lose a war because well, he's a loser. Fundamentally, he's a loser through and through.
I mean, humor is going to be a good thing, isn't it? Because the thing he cannot stand, the thing he absolutely cannot stand, is being mocked, is being belittled. And I think that almost certainly comes back to childhood trauma. If you listen to Mary Trump, one of his relatives, that's people driving cars showing their support in London. If you listen to it, he was almost certainly bullied as a child. He's incredibly sensitive to being belittled and mocked. And I think that's where NAFO comes in. I mean, this is one of the angles. The other angle we need to adopt, because he spews things out, you know, this, that, and the other, like spaghetti against the wall. We need to continually ask him how. Not like, you won't get through to the MAGA cult by insulting him and arguing and getting into these partisan arguments. That strengthens them. But if we continually just ask the question, how are you going to do that, Trump? How are you going to, end the war? How are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? That may be a way to plant seeds of doubt into his supporters' minds, because there's no way he can come back with any coherent idea or plan about how he does any of the things that he's talking about.
Has he been asked the question? It's a question for both of you. I haven't seen this. I've followed most of the interviews. But has he ever been asked the question about Bret Baier, for example, who typically is not too complacent about how he questions? Has he been asked the question as to whether and how he would end the war? Because he said, I'll do this in one day. Evidently, he can't. But it's not good enough for us to tell him that he can't. I don't think that the question has yet come forward, has it?
Well, if I may go in first. In a recent interview, he obfuscated, basically. And that's a technique he uses very often. When he gets a straight question, he comes out with these one-liners that he likes to use. And then he shifts the conversation away from the question. And most journalists don't nail him down. You would actually have to have a journalist who asks him the question 9 times in a row. You would have to have a very hardcore, sort of BBC-style journalist, a sort of traditional Newsnight or Hard Talk type journalist, to really nail him until he answers the damn question. Unfortunately, that you're not going to get that from Fox News in most cases. So it has been difficult. But I would like to mention also one other data point, which is important. And it worries me a bit because I'm not sure that it's true. But I think it's been communicated either because it's wishful thinking on the part of some people who support Trump. But it came from General Kellogg, who used to be the security advisor to Mike Pence, the former vice president. And he has stated that part of the solution, part of the so-called one-day solution, would be a massive increase of the quality and volume of weapons supplied to Ukraine as a threat. So basically the idea, but that's General Kellogg talking, and very few people have noticed. So, and I think that's...
Sorry to interrupt, Edward, but Trump exactly said that in his interview with Tucker. Tucker asked him, what if Putin doesn't agree to your terms? And he said, well, then Ukraine will receive so much weapons like they never received. So there is, I agree with you that humiliation is a really important motivation factor for this guy. So I if Putin thinks that he will outplay him and get a deal on his terms, that might turn out the other way, I think.
Okay, no, thanks. I didn't know I didn't know that he had said that to Tucker himself he had said it to Tucker. So thanks a lot, Mathieu, for that. I'd heard it from General Kellogg, not from Trump. So thanks for adding that in. Of course, the problem with that is that it doesn't genuinely tell us where with the trajectory for the war to terminate on acceptable conditions. Because it still seems to me that what Trump would like to do, and he's already started, I think that's an important criticism. He did the first part first, which is to block the funding to Ukraine. That puts Ukraine on a downward trajectory of vulnerability. And he's already doing that now before being potentially president the second time. And so if he gets his way, then what would happen later is that Russia creates more and more facts on the ground. Russia is stronger. Then he merely threatens Putin with giving Ukraine lots and lots of weapons. It could be a pretend deal, and then we get into a dirty Minsk III type of stuff, and then Trump tries to claim all the credit. Trump is not being honest about the exit of the conflict and the territorial integrity of Ukraine and all of that. And besides, why is Trump's position then, as we understand it, to merely threaten to give all the weapons in the world to Ukraine? Why not just support giving all the weapons to Ukraine right now? And why block the flow of weapons to Ukraine now? So I think we can quite easily deconstruct that logic as being a dishonest one. Either you want Ukraine to win or you don't. If you want Ukraine to win, number one, you don't block the flow. And number two, you increase it and you do everything you can to ensure that there's ATACMS, that there's everything else going in. That's not what he's doing. So judge the man by his actions, not by his words.
And that's the other part. He, of course, said that he would negotiate with Putin about, say, a deal first. And only if that fails, he would provide capabilities. Exactly what you alluded to. He is caving before and therefore makes it impossible that this deal ever comes to be. It's not going to happen. And I think we know this already. Just because he constantly highlights that he was the first one to ever release any proper weapons, the javelins to Ukraine, which, yes, it's true. His administration, the DOD, did this, and he had to sign off on it. And his national security advisor, by the way, a very decent man, was the one who actually worked on this. But that's a different thing. He is not the kind of guy Europe can rely on. This brings me to the question for all of you. If the Czechs find a way that Norwegians, Danes, Dutch, Canadians, and others help them acquire ammunition, and therefore Ukraine can tide itself over into, or say, probably August, September, will the remaining Europeans, the main large nations, industrial nations, be able, together with the Americans, to provide sufficient capability so that what Mick Ryan said, that 2024 will be a year of gathering strength, can still be the case and we survive this election? Because it seems to me that this artillery ammunition from South Korea and from the African continent will be absolutely critical.
I'll go first again, if you don't mind. I think, yes, I mean, there's some of the work that's been done on those who monitor this more closely on the artillery production situation. I've not tracked this in detail, but there's several researchers, Gustav Grissel, and there's this Canadian commentator, Colby, can't remember his last name.
Colby Bagwell, yeah. He was once, an assistant to one of the leading politicians in America, in Canada, and is now doing research.
So
there's five or six people in Europe who track this. Thomas Tyner will be with us this
afternoon.
Yes,
great, so perfect,
listen,
perfect.
He will talk about exactly that if you want to listen in. But carry on.
Well, it seems to me, from what I understood, that the trajectories are such that indeed the next approximately 9 months are very, very, very hard. North of that, we could finally begin to be on trajectories where, provided we have both Europe and the US supplying, this will work. So into 2025, it works. The trouble is now. So indeed, I agree that it is pivotal to either release the US assistance immediately, or for the Czechs to be successful with that deal, or preferably both. And there's still other obstacles on the way. But yes, I mean, there's all to play for this year. And I think we can be more optimistic about next year.
Jonathan, did you speak about this topic with Jack Watling? Can't get Jonathan. He's probably just passing by the Russian embassy. But Edward, maybe let's continue this on this topic. In the Rusi report, Watling had highlighted that essentially the attrition in these stocks would at the beginning only be seen in part and ever so slightly. And at some point in time, if the artillery ammunition stops being available, and we hear in certain areas of the front line this is the case, the Ukrainians waiting until the very last moment when they need it, then they fire. Otherwise, they don't, because they simply do not know how much of their stocks in the first and second and third line of the front they will have available.
Of course. I mean, that's a logical military analysis from first principles. And Jack Watling is a lot better at that kind of analysis than I am. But I mean, I just agree with the logic. I think it's quite clear. It stands on its own. Obviously, if you're in a situation where you know you have less, then you ration, and then you try to find the optimal pattern of use over time. And so, yes, you will fire a lot less initially, and then you will try to find more to finally hold on to certain positions. But in the end, you'll have to retreat. You'll have to abandon positions, and you'll try to make that a very slow grind for the enemy so that there's no major movement by the enemy. But of course, as this accumulates, there's cumulative territorial loss, there's cumulative positional loss, and I mean, it is just incredibly dangerous. And so I think there must be a sense of urgency here. I mean, there is in some of the political communication we see, but these remain incredibly dangerous times. At a certain point in time, if you really do run out of artillery, there comes a point where you have to retreat. And so we are looking at the Russians just advancing. Fortunately, it's still quite slow, but I think the image of a dam that could break is maybe a bit simplistic, but there's still some truth to it. So we have to be aware of how much is at stake.
All righty, and with that, in about a minute or two, we will also be joined by Rear Admiral Dr. Chris Parry, and we'll be talking exactly about these topics from a military perspective. I presume that he can give us all a run for the money, but I think it will be interesting. And Edward, please stay with us if you like. This is something else which we discussed a little earlier, Edward, today, and before Dr. Parry comes up. The lack of integration, industrial integration, and the logistics chain between the Western European nations and production capabilities in Ukraine still leads to the fact that Ukraine cannot kit out their soldiers, even with the basic kits, as much as they should. If you compare it to the example of the Second World War, when American resources were brought over, the basic kit was always there. There was more than enough of it. There were more shoes than you could walk in. And it had to be. Same goes for rifles, ammunition, and the likes. As soon as the logistics were set up, the war was on a path where the soldiers could win it. At the moment, civil society in Ukraine, many other NGOs, supporting organizations still have to raise funds and help soldiers equip. How can we convince the Europeans that it's time to switch to a different mode? Because it's nice to have financial assistance, but this is about military production.
Right. I mean, exactly. I think that's a fantastic question. I think it needs to be written up in a compelling way. And I think multiple experts ought to do this. And then here's a couple of ideas for the argument. So we have done really a lot on the side of emptying out, not completely, of course. We know we're not doing it completely. That's another problem. But we've pulled out a lot out of our stocks. Why? Because it's faster. But nothing replaces... if you have a long war, of course, you have to switch to massively higher production. And in order to switch to massively higher production, history teaches us you have to have a completely different regime. You have to have effectively a war economy regime, not just in words. And this has become a bit of a silly political debate, because in France you have Macron saying, oh, we're doing war economy. No, you're not. France is not doing war economy. And then in Germany you have Pistorius saying, I don't want to do war economy. And we have to say, well, you should do war economy. And what does war economy mean? It means it's a completely different legal legislative setup. You have to have special wartime legislation, and some countries even still have the legislation on the books. In other countries, maybe the legislation has lapsed. It needs to be rewritten, repassed through parliaments, etc. But the thing is, there has to be the budgets. There has to be a planning for this. It's a planning solution. You can have market mechanisms within it, but a lot of it, frankly, is to be centrally planned. If you want to ramp up production, you have to give the certainty to the producers. Otherwise, they will not produce. You have to promise that you will absolutely buy 1 million shells or whatever it is, and that the contracts will not be changed. They will not be canceled if there's a new government. The quantities will not be modified. You want to also reduce the complexity. You don't want all the political stuff jumping in, trying to distract attention. What matters is the quantities that get produced, and they just have to be produced. So there's a range of... There's a whole ton of, if you like, legislative work, design work that needs to be done. It needs to be a complete strategy. And there's a whole legislative angle, special powers, powers to commandeer resources, also powers to remove certain obstacles to do with health, safety, and environmental rules, because we're talking about the production of explosives, and then there's an issue of the disposal of waste and all of that. I'm not saying we want to do things dirty and have lots of industrial accidents, but this has to be streamlined, and there has to be a political realization, and it has to migrate all the way up to the top, that the whole machinery needs to get moving. And it is the only way you can do this sort of thing, because otherwise you just never have the annual production rates that you need. So really we need literally to do a war economy or pre-war economy for real. And this needs to be written up. It's possible to do it. Our nations have done it, but so long ago that people don't even remember very well. I think that needs to be pushed on. Yes, absolutely.
All righty. In the meantime, I've sent both from the host phone as well as from mine links to our friend, Rear Admiral Chris Perry, and I hope that he can see them by now, because I'd really like to cycle them up. Otherwise, Chris, if you can hear me, then on the bottom left, just simply press the request button. That should also work, and then we can cycle you up. Let's see whether that helps us out of the conundrum, which is Twitter. And whilst we're waiting for that, so let's see. David Bailey, you had a question.
Yeah, the idea that we should make this point at a high level from multiple voices to governments, and you know, obviously the UK, the US government, the German government. Why don't we use the space right now to put together a coalition of the willing, if you like, and start that ball rolling to put something like an open letter to government from relative experts? Because my feeling is that generally in policy bodies, there's a realization that there's been a realization for a long time that this is going to be an issue. And the voices have just not been heard and not been responded to. So I think there are a large number of people that would be willing to partake in penning that letter and putting together the data and getting it published. So why not? Is that something we could do?
I think it could be done, but we need to get the right people. We need to get people who've had experience in hands-on experience in defense procurement and defense industry. I mean, these people are identifiable, right? I mean, through the various contacts we have in the expert community, the people we already know, we should be able to gather the right inputs so as to come up with, I don't know, a list of 6, 8, 10 absolute must-dos, and to cover the whole picture, like I said. So it's on the financing, it's on financial guarantees for producers, it's on legislative simplifications to make the supply chains work better, to enable production to work faster. It's on guaranteeing the solidity of long-term contracts. It might involve having exemptions from ordinary competition law, ordinary EU law. There's all sorts of issues to look at, although a lot of these exemptions already exist. So we would also need some legal expertise, as a matter of fact. And that's probably a very rare profile, someone who's actually a good lawyer who actually knows about legislation that governs the defense industry, because there's probably a number of obstacles there that need to be lifted. And I actually don't know personally someone who has that profile, but if we could find someone like that, that could be very interesting. But I think first port of call, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, with the likes of Jack Watling, Gustav Gressel, people like that, we could already eat up a lot of the basic ground and have the basic right ideas, and then maybe to go further, identify a couple of experts who might not be very well known at this point and very rare, very scarce expertise, emergency legislation to commandeer resources to speed up production, things like that.
Well, the interesting thing is that Armin Papperger said it, and we had a discussion on this, that if and when they were to receive orders, they could make capacity expansion decisions and quickly. So this was 2 years ago, of course. He repeated it, and some orders have been made. But I think it's a key element that we missed the time window for just ordering to what you just highlighted, that we actually need to be, make sure that we simply say, okay, fine, we will organize this in a public-private partnership without much procurement. We'll do this as under wartime conditions, because there is no alternative. The Finns have done this, by the way. They've activated their protocols to supply the army with backfill and additional ammunition and additional equipment. They've just done this on the quiet. The Swedes have a preparation in their law that in case of national emergency, they could do it. They haven't activated it, of course. But there's many nations who have the capability for this. The question is, how can we find the actually muster the spirit for this?